From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. I'm being splashed by sun in the offices of Oprah Winfrey at OWN. We're here to talk about the adaptation of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks with its star and executive producer, Oprah Winfrey. Hi, Oprah.
Hi, Elvis.
And the writer, director, the adapter, George C. Wolfe. George, good to see you again.
Good to see you, too.
And if you guys could tell us what the film's about.
I'll let that guy tell you.
That guy, George.
What is the film about? The film is about a woman named Deborah Lacks who has been searching her entire life to know her mother. And turns out her mother, in 1951 in Baltimore, she died of a very aggressive case of cervical cancer. Johns Hopkins took a tissue sample of her cells, and they turned out to be the first cells that could live outside of the human body. And the whole biotech industry did not exist until Henrietta's cells came along, called HeLa. And she has been responsible, HeLa's cells have been responsible for transforming everything in science, just about everything in science. They were used in polio to find the cure for polio, and it continues all up into HIV. And there's this phenomenon of these cells that have gone around the world and then blocks away from where this was happening. There was a woman who the whole family knew nothing was happening like this, and so she goes on a journey to find out all she can about her mother, Deborah.
Yeah. Deborah Lacks.
Goes on a journey to find out everything she needs to know.
It was interesting because in the book, it said that the cervical cancer cells were indomitable. Unlike most of us, they just wouldn't die.
Yeah.
And in fact, Henrietta herself, for a long time, didn't even show any signs of suffering. She got radium treatments and still was this powerhouse of a person.
Yeah.
And she's an unusual physical figure.
As she's being burned from the inside, as her son later has this really powerful scene at the dinner table talking about, you didn't see what happened to her, how thin she got, and how that whatever they were doing to her just burned her up inside. I became interested in this story because I lived in Baltimore and was a great citizen of Baltimore. I think I became a woman in Baltimore is what I always say. And being in the community, in and around, being on the streets where Deborah Lacks lived and worked, being on the streets where Henrietta Lacks lived in Turner Station, I never once in 8 years heard the name Henrietta Lacks. So I am a student of African-American culture just because I've been reading since I was a little girl. So I grew up reading stories about, you know, Jubilee by Margaret Walker.
Never heard of this book.
which we've talked about before, was one of my favorite books when I was, you know, in the seventh grade, Jubilee, and I'm reciting for Margaret Walker's Jubilee. I'm reciting Fannie Lou Hamer. I'm reciting Sojourner Truth.
You have to tell a story about your high school competition.
Yes, yes. I had a high school competition where I used the entire excerpt from Margaret Walker's Jubilee, you know, portraying Virey Brown, and I won the oratorical contest for 2 years in a row, and I was state champion. So my point is, I grew up as a student, just really something in me has always been inclined to know about who came before me. And I have been drawn to strong African-American female figures. Not that I don't appreciate all the men, but I have a strong identity with all of them. You know, and for a long time I used to say, oh, I think I'm, you know, Sojourner Truth reincarnated or something. If there was one person I would come back as, it would be Sojourner Truth, because she was able to, you know, speak amongst the slaves and then go and talk to Lincoln. She was able to traverse all of it. So I feel a kinship, a kindred spirit with all of them. And I'm always interested in a story that allows us to see the inner beings, inner workings, the depth of what it means to be an African-American woman in this country. And I was drawn to it because I had never heard of it before. And my theory always has been, oh, if I haven't heard of it, there's at least a million other people who haven't heard of it. So I'm hoping those million other people will watch.
Well, I guess, you know, so watching it and then went and read the book after, I found myself thinking about, I always wondered, George, if you were raised a religious person, because so many things you do as either a director or a writer about the gap between purgatory and hell. you know, people suffering, and they're aware of the fact that hell is the next step for them. And I thought about that in that Deborah's voice speech in the beginning of the book.
I was raised Baptist in Frankfort, Kentucky, and I went to First Baptist Church.
Well, that would be religious.
That would be definitely religious. But I was fascinated. And also, one of the people I met very early on was this man named Dr. Patillo, who was very protective of the Lacks family.
In fact, Rebecca says in the book that, you know, when she asks about it, he goes, why?
Why should you be the one to tell the story?
Exactly. Yeah. And he's an extraordinarily fascinating man. And he...
one of the first African Americans to study at Johns Hopkins.
Exactly, and to touch HeLa cells, and also was involved in the founding of Morehouse Medical School. And he discussed the spirituality of the HeLa cells. And so it's so fascinating to me to have a medical science thinking human being also discussing the spiritual connection. And that conversation had a huge impact on me, because I think in some respects, Rebecca is a person of science and Deborah is an incredible person of faith.
Yeah.
And here was this person who was putting the two together. So in many respects, I think that's part of what the film is about. It's about putting the science and faith together.
Well, that's what's interesting to me too. As the character, she didn't really understand the science. And as an actor, trying to use my instrument to recreate her, I didn't really understand the science through her, but I understood the faith. And that faith was the through line for me, because, you know, in one of the most pivotal scenes when she is saying, help me, Jesus, help me, let me, Lord, let this go, I could relate to what that thing is where you've carried this burden for so long and you just want some relief from it. You're exhausted by it. You're worn out by it. The weariness is what I was trying to convey in that moment, in that scene. And, you know, George, speaking about being religious, it would be, I mean, I don't know many Black people born of that era who didn't have religion mm-hmm. as the background of their lives and as a staple in their mm-hmm. lives, actually, because how else were you going to survive? I mean, the church served as your doctor, as your nurse, as your comforter,
community center.
And
your community center, your psychologist, your therapist, your comforter. I mean, all of that. So she used her faith and her belief that there was something bigger and better beyond herself just to keep getting up every morning.
But again, for me, because I think about the Colored Museum or Jelly's Last Jam, some of these things about people having this awareness that kind of dooms them to suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And I almost wonder if that's kind of the thing that drew you to this, because she, again, that Deborah's voice monologue in the beginning of the book, she talks about being asked about so much, she can't get away from it.
Yeah.
And
to me, what I'm perpetually fascinated by is that dynamic. How do you extract from the past the fuel from the pain so you can move forward? Mm-hmm. So that the pain of the past
doesn't
can either consume you and stop you, but there's also the potential of the pain from the past has information, has fuel, and if you can figure out how to transform it from something that overwhelms you into something that can empower you, then you move forward. And to me, that's the journey of Deborah. And I'm just as a writer and as a thinker, I'm perpetually fascinated with that. There's a line in Color Museum, whereas I can't live inside of yesterday's pain, I can't live without it.
As I was watching it, I find myself thinking about permutation a lot.
Yeah.
As I was watching this.
That's interesting.
Because that sort of awareness of this thing that's bigger than you, that you don't quite understand, but it's still this shadow that exists over you all the
time. That's very interesting. It's very interesting.
And
that's because he's Elvis Mitchell, and this is the treatment. I mean, where else is anybody going to talk about permutation? In all the interviews we've done on the road show for Henrietta, no one has ever mentioned the word permutation. Thank you so much. Dr. Mitchell.
It's a play that he wrote. Anyway.
I know. But nobody's brought it up. There you go.
There you go.
I'm just making this up as I go along. But I just thought about that because, again, when we talked about this, I told you what I was really thrilled by in the performance is that she's possessed by these rages that are almost biblical. And then they mm-hmm. pass. Mm-hmm. And I just wonder how you got to do that, because that's a real fury. That's as much a fury as the world not giving her a place as a fury at herself.
Mm-hmm. I had to lean into the director and trust that that would show up, because I don't carry any fury. I mean, I work with the famous acting coach, Susan Batson, for a week, just going line by line through the script. And I was like, I don't have that thing buried. I don't have that rage. I don't.
But you have a recognition of injustice.
I have a recognition of injustice. Isn't it? But I had said to Susan, actually, when she left my house, I said, I am going to trust, you know, I'm doing this mostly because of George. And I've said that many times, even when he wasn't sitting right next to me. So I'm going to lean into George. I'm going to lean in, and I'm going to trust that he's not going to let me embarrass myself. And she said, I don't think he's going to let you embarrass himself, but you got to find a way to get to the bottom yourself. Because she goes, I know George, you know, he is an actor's director, but you've got to find a way to find that bottom for yourself. So I was pretty confident that I could find the bottom, so confident that the very first day, can I tell this story? The very first day, so I'm like, I'm going to find the bottom, I'm going to find the bottom, I'm going to find the bottom. And the very first day where it's just a phone call, and she's sitting in bed for the second phone call. She gets the first phone call and she agrees to have the conversation. And then the second phone call, she's like depressed and she's not going to take the phone call. So I'm like, I got to find the bottom. I'm going to go all the way to the bottom. So I'm in the bed and I start to cry. I hit the bottom and I'm there and crying because, you know, my history has been, I hadn't been able to cry on cue in The Color Purple. So I now, like, I want to make sure I can cry. I just want to make sure that I can reach the bottom and do it. So I'm in the bed and I'm crying over the phone call. And George is like, He comes in. He comes in after two takes. I'm like, but he comes in and he says, are you all right? I said, yes. He goes, no tears. Let's just cut the tears. I go, you want to cut the tears? He goes, we have nowhere to go. We have nowhere to go. If you're going to start with the tears, we have nowhere to go. We're only in the second scene in the movie, and you're already crying. So we have nowhere to go. I was just trying to say, I can do it. See, I can do it. I can reach the bottom, sir. I can find my way to the bottom. So anyway, I trusted that moment actually allowed me to lean in because I thought, oh, he knows you don't need that here.
The man who's being called out by my guest, Oprah Winfrey, is the writer and director of the
Immortal George C. Wolfe.
George C. Wolfe is the treatment. But again, it's not just that rage, but it's also like it never happened. I mean, that's the thing, too, that's so fascinating about this. And she even talks about it in the book, Rebecca Skloot. But she, and it's interesting, talking about being external, she sort of assigns the blame to medical things.
Right.
And it's more than that. It's
correct.
Much more than that.
Yeah, correct.
Absolutely.
Correct.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, and for the Deborah, I mean, Deborah was all over the place. I mean, she actually, in real life, as she states in the film, was on 21 different medications. And so to be able to have the range of what that looks like and feels like, I think the great benefit to me and also to Rose Byrne, who plays Rebecca Skloot, is that we were able to hear hours and hours and hours of tapes that Rebecca Skloot, the author of the book, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, had recorded over a period of a year in every single meeting with Deborah or any member of the family. She was recording the whole time. So I get to hear Deborah's voice, actually, on tape saying, girl, did you see the Oprah show today? I saw Oprah, and she had all these people on the show talking about their ancestors. And if this woman could find her ancestors and they find out that it was all white, I know I can find out who my mama was. And I hear her on tape actually saying that one day she wants me to play her. And that was the thing that really sealed the deal for me. Having George come aboard and find a way in through Deborah's discovering of her mother was one thing that confirmed it for me, or affirmed that maybe I should do it. But it was hearing Deborah in Deborah's voice say that she wanted me to do it. So this is sort of, for me, this is an ode to her. This is a celebration of her journey here on Earth, the path that she took to have the story of her mother revealed.
We'll take a break and give Oprah a chance to finish adjusting her microphone. It's the treatment. We're talking about the immortal life of Henrietta Lacks.
I know, the microphone has to be right.
And sure as well, there's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's the treatment I'm being made
insightful.
Fun of by Oprah.
It's not being made fun of. It's really, this is the thing. May I just say this?
I'm sure you may.
Okay.
It's your office.
Okay. It's my office. Sun is going down here now. But it's a real compliment to you that you are so thoughtful and insightful with your questioning. It's really, I'm acknowledging your brilliance in asking questions that you have actually thought about. You know?
Well, as we could say in my neighborhood, if I could blush, I would. My guests are Oprah Winfrey and George C. Wolfe, the star, executive producer, and writer, director of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks. You were talking about the size of her personality, and Rebecca Skloot even acknowledges that in the opening of the book, where she says that she felt Henrietta's hand over her, that she told her she needed to get married to get married. When the editor of the book who told her she's going the wrong way died, it was Henrietta's way of reaching out to do that. So I think that Deborah's obsession even sort of overtook Rebecca in some way, didn't it?
Well, yeah, I think. Well, I'll let you speak to that, George.
Yeah, I think very much so. I mean, I think you have somebody who's looking at this subject, i.e. Rebecca, objectively. She's fascinated by Henrietta, the woman, which is wonderful and startling, but she's also looking at the science. And then you have this person who has a ferocious, it's not an inquisitive mind. She has a ferocious primal desire to know. And it becomes it's a motor. That's the
key word is primal.
Yeah, it's she's got to know. She has to know. Yeah. I have to know this story. I can no longer exist without knowing.
Yeah.
No, I guess I brought this up too just because I thought that one of the things that maybe helped you connect with this too, Oprah, is the fact that you play so many people who have a mission. I mean, we can go back to The Color Purple, or your scenes in Selma. I mean, characters.
I never played nobody like this, though. This is the most challenging and actually difficult. I was scared to say yes to this.
Why were you scared? But again, what I was saying is you play people who have a determination, have a fixed idea of things that they want to do. Yeah. I'm not saying this isn't bigger than that, because it is. And that's why I was telling you that volcanic rage and then turned into this utter, I think, scary calm. It must have been a kind of a terrifying.
You're talking about the character?
Yeah, the character's rage, and then that.
Yeah, for her, it she wasn't analytical about it at all. It just happened. So she would have an outburst, and not even know really how to explain that to herself, because that's the nature of being bipolar. She just knew she had some issues, and so she would have that, and then the next day not know how to really explain it. Because she couldn't even explain it to herself. And when she's in the car breaking out in hives and going through that manic state, she thinks she's okay. I just get this way sometimes, is what she would say. So
yeah, but it's interesting because you could make characters like that, because we have seen characters like this in black fiction and black drama so often. The danger is that these people can become archetypal and you kind of detach from them. So you've got to, like, I don't want to say grounded because that's too much of a cliche, but they've got to feel like they've got real
weight. It's not
weight.
A cliche if you say it.
Nobody's ever said that to me before.
So she has seen an image which is violence is being perpetuated against her big sister. And it's an image that is impossible to process. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to process something, seeing an image that is that cruel. That is cruel and that horrifying. So it unhinges her. It unhinges something, because she is such an empathetic person. It unhinges something inside of her, and seeing her sister's that vulnerable state activates, because she is such an empathetic person, activates all of her vulnerability, and it all comes rushing up.
And she didn't even know what to
do with it. And it's I'm explaining her bipolarism, but it just, it's like we all could conceivably respond the same way when you are seeing a manifestation of cruelty that is impossible for you to process.
Now, what's interesting is that, you know, I obviously read the book, read the script, but I had not seen the picture of Elsie until the day we actually shot it. So I'd asked to not to see it, so that the moment the doctor shows her that photograph, that was the first time I had seen the photograph, because I wanted that thing to be real. And it does. It made you gasp inside yourself, the nature of what's going on here. You see the white hand around her neck, and, you know, it opened up all the wounds that Deborah had been carrying for herself, mm-hmm. all the things that she suspected or maybe imagined or wondered came to be manifest in that photograph when she saw it for the first time. And I'd seen none of the photographs. You know, all those photographs of the black women with the bands over their eyes that they covered, those were real photographs from
Crownsville.
From Crownsville, from the actual hospital. So sitting there in that scene looking at those women was not hard to let yourself sink into the reality of what that would have meant for all of those young black girls.
It's so fascinating, too, because there are a couple of things I thought when I saw it and then when I read the book. There is what I call a strain of justifiable black paranoia in this country, mm-hmm. from this to the Tuskegee experiment.
Right, mm-hmm. right.
And it's just one of these things that's so hard to explain that the idea of dramatizing it mm-hmm. and dramatizing what may seem to people who don't know or don't want to understand irrational, but in fact is the most rational kind
100%.
Of thing, even though it's outsized.
100%. That was my big question about Crownsville was for nothing but it was the hospital for crazy Negroes, as Deborah calls it. Everybody in there
was
in theory crazy. And mm-hmm. we're wondering, some of the people probably, you know, had various forms of being mentally challenged. How many people were in there because they were just mad? How many people were just in there because they had a rage they could not understand?
Yeah.
You know?
Or just didn't behave conventionally. 100%. And what do you do? What do you do?
With I mean, somebody with OCD could have been in a place like this.
Oh, absolutely.
100%.
That's what would have happened.
Exactly.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing in addition to that was you were talking about Baltimore, which is I think a place that this story really had to happen in because it's that weird intersection of the North and the South.
Yeah, interesting.
So it's these two sort of things pushing against each other where you've got a center of medical research, John Hopkins. You got people who still act like Southerners. You know, Henrietta basically took everybody and took care of everybody.
Yeah.
In her way, Deborah tried to be that person too, but she couldn't really. And she wanted to look for an explanation because that's what Northerners do. But as a Southerner, you think there's something bigger than yourself that's faith-based. So it's all these seeming contradictions that make this story, I think, even have more impact.
As only you would analyze. I think that's fantastic. That's why we're on the treatment. My gosh!
That's why we're in treatment on the treatment.
That's why we're in treatment. I mean, whatever you just said, I agree with.
That's the story of my life. Whatever you just said,
whatever
just keep saying.
Whatever you just said, I think it's fascinating. That's really fascinating.
But you know, you having spent time in Baltimore, you know it is this kind of weird thing.
Yeah,
it's
it
not
is.
The North, and it's not the South.
Right. And there's kind of a complex there that I felt. Perhaps it's no longer still there, but I always felt like Baltimore has this complex about, you know, D.C. and we're not getting enough attention. There's this feeling there, I think, because you're neither one or the other, really. You're neither one or the other.
But I do feel that really lends itself to this because the country is just 20 minutes away or a really harsh urban environment, a terrifying urban environment, is within walking distance. That, to me, really feels like it informs all of this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you, again, you had a firsthand experience of all the different sides of Baltimore covering it as a reporter.
That's right. So it's all it becomes its own character, certainly in Deborah's life. And, you know, when we went to visit the family there, her son Alfred was talking about the fact that she worked three jobs and she worked at this, you know, restaurant and would, you know, bring food home at the end of the day for the kids and then, you know, sleep for a few hours and get up and go to the next job. The thing that makes this story so important, in my opinion, is that this was just an ordinary woman. You know, this didn't come from, somebody with, you know, extraordinary background. These were just ordinary folks who were literally a part of this experiment and had, in as late as the 70s, still no information as to why their blood was being taken or what was going on with them. And, you know, so often we've been asked, what do you want people to take away from it? Well, my thing is, you do the film, you offered it to the world, let people take what they want. But what George has said over and over, and I continue to, you know, feel so strongly, is that every story in every family is important. And I think if people come from seeing our film with a sense of, you know, thinking more about their own history, legacy, what's been passed down from them, if we touch that nerve, along with allowing people to see who Henrietta was and what that yearning is to know yourself, then we would have succeeded. We're lucky we get to do it on the HBO platform, because, I mean, I'd be sick if we had to do a box office opening. I'd be sick right now.
Would you?
Yeah, because whether or not you're seen, you're number one that weekend or not, because I've been through that before, does not determine whether or not the film was worthy of being seen, of whether or not you've created something that's really of value. And to be able to watch it within, you know, the comfort of your own home, with friends, to see it, you know, basically whenever you want to see it on HBO now, is, you know, is a great gift to us. Because when Deborah imagined this, she imagined it, you know, being up on a screen and people going to the theaters and see it. It will live on in ways that we never imagined that it could, because we have this platform of HBO.
Mm-hmm. I was actually going to ask you that question about theatrical, because
I've been in that position where you hold something dear to your heart, you work on it for 10 years, beloved, and put it out into the world. I remember the very first morning, I didn't know anything about marketing, or I just thought, oh, we're going to put the movie out and people are going to go see it. And movie comes out on a Friday, I think it was October 16th. That Saturday morning, I get a call that says, it's done. It's over. It's over? Yeah, it's over. Wow. You're number four. You're number four. It's only Saturday morning at 9 o'clock. How can I be number four? Well, you've been beaten by something, something, something. And all I remember was Bride of Chucky. And I said, who is Chucky?
That's a philosophical question we all ask ourselves.
Exactly. Who is Chucky?
Who is Chucky? What is Chucky? And who is his bride?
Exactly. And so, his bride is not beloved.
And his bride is not beloved. That's for sure. So, I mean, that put me into like, I mean, and my next question was, somebody, please, can you find me some macaroni and cheese for breakfast? So I went into a, George, for you, that would have been pie.
Exactly. But
so to not to have that kind of pressure of like, oh, we gotta beat the Bride of Chucky. But people can see it as they wish to see it, because it's HBO. It's not even TV.
There you go.
That should be an ad slogan. And we're out of time.
Are we out of time?
We are done. Let me thank Oprah Winfrey, the executive producer and star, and George C. Wolfe, the writer and director of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is apparently on HBO, which is not TV. Thank you guys so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for being
so thoughtful in your questioning.
Yep. Thank you.
That's why we came on the treatment, y'all.
Exactly.
Let me also thank our recording engineer, Kat Ure, who also mixes the show. It's edited by Blake White, who's associate producer. I'm really hungry. It's the treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.